Okay, we have one of the engineers that work for us. It was a Sprintown, of all places. And he has a modern receiver, and he basically doesn't seem to have any problem. By the way, a lot of people are disconnecting from cable and satellite because they're not interested in paying $150 to $200 a month anymore for TV. So there's been a lot of cord cutting, but a lot of that's being, just a lot of that slack is being taken up by the internet. All the major broadcasters now have their shows available on the internet for you to watch. With the modern devices, or more modern devices, you have much less of an issue. Whether you're going to have 90% reliability, I'm not going to guess at that, because, I mean, if you're in an area where you had trouble before, even with a new set, if a plane comes overhead and it's coming by, it might cause a disturbance. The metal reflecting that stuff at you. It could possibly go outside the range of that equalizer to be able to decode it. Not a perfect world. Although I live in Plainview, which is just before Jane Hill, where everything drops off afterwards, and I get 100% reception. I have no problem. I don't have to twist the antenna. I don't have to do anything to it. I even get the New Jersey Public Television without a problem. I get the Connecticut station without a problem. So, you know, maybe it's time for you to move up towards a little more modern stuff, and you won't be so hard on it. Detroit WK,
pretty fine, Eric, and I'm going to pick up with Paul in a second. So I've got to come up to the 21st century, and one other crazy comment. A year or two ago, a couple of pessimists were saying that over-the-air broadcast was about to become obsolete, that other techniques for delivering broadcast information to people was going to become dominant, and broadcast was going to be abandoned. There were a couple of pessimists a couple of years ago saying things like that. From what I'm hearing, and I'm guessing, that was way premature prediction that the sky is falling, and there's no longer any movement in that direction in any major metro area. Can I say those words, Eric? KE2EJ, KQLIW?
Oh, you're absolutely wrong about that. They're still trying to kill broadcasting. It's all political, and there's a lot of heavyweights behind it. There's an auction that was supposed to happen in June, where you may have heard about channel repacking, where they would force the broadcasters to either sell their 6 megahertz so they could chop off some more of the upper part and sell it to AT&T and Verizon and other people. And it would mean that several broadcasters would have to combine their streams into a single transmitter, which of course will mean reduced resolution for people. And the previous FCC commissioner, Jankowski, basically, he's an anti-broadcasting guy. Whereas the new guy, Wheeler, is a little more reasonable about it. He's actually now delayed the auction until 2015. So, and there's a lot of technical stuff in terms of how they're making measurements and saying that how a metropolitan area covers the viewers. The methodologies in which they use, or the methodology which was previously used, was shown to be very faulty. So there's a lot of political BS that's going on right now. There is a lot of big dollars behind trying to force it to go away, but let me let it drop for a second. The one thing that Homeland Security and a few other departments are saying to Congress and the FCC, and by the way, Congress enacted a set of rules saying that you can't put the broadcasters out of business. If they want to do this, they have to do it voluntarily, and you have to still serve the public good. When electricity goes out and the internet fails and all these other wonderful technologies go away, broadcasting still works. So that's the one saving grace that they have at the moment.
Among this particular audience of wireless enthusiastic people, radio transmitting, receiving, whatever, ham radio people, we sort of believe that there is an American right, the American right of life, liberty, and the pursuit of over-the-air broadcast television. That's got to be guaranteed. You can't take that away from us. If somebody wants to take that away, who the hell do we have to get out of office to make sure that doesn't happen? Over to you, Eric. I'm getting a little emotional on this one. KQEJ, KQRIW.
If you have some interesting reading, go to FCC.gov, and you can see a lot of this stuff that's going on. If you go /MB with Media Bureau, you can see the very specific NPRMs in terms of what's supposed to happen. And you can read the individual commissioner's take on each one. The new guy is much more reasonable than the last guy was, so thank goodness for that. There's a lot of things at play here. There's a lot of big money. And also, interestingly enough, they're being sued by the smaller wireless companies, because when AT&T and Verizon and T-Mobile gobbles everything up, there's nothing for the little guy to operate with. So there's a lot of shenanigans that's happening. And then you have the NAB and the individual broadcast organizations that say, you know, based on the Act of 1934, the public owns the airwaves, not the individual broadcasters. We give you a license, and that you serve the public by using this 6 megahertz space that we've allocated and allotted to use, but that 6 megahertz belongs to the public. And ever since Reagan and the change in the way government operates, the way they're operating this day, they're kind of taking that away. And there's a lot of people fighting against it at the moment. So if you're interested in reading, do a search, a Google search on channel repacking, and you'll have readings they'll think you're here to read. KQRIW, KQEJ.
Keep up the battle, Eric, and don't give up the broadcasting ship. And Paul, WS2N, I hope you're able to tell us that way out there in the wilds of Ronkonkoma, where you need Ungawa the guide to find your QTH, I'm having some fun with him. I'd like to believe that you're getting reasonably good over-the-air television broadcasts. Maybe that's what you were about to tell us. WS2N, K2RIW, go ahead, Paul.
Okay, Dick. Yes, you were wondering if you thought it has improved. Well, my boxes haven't changed. I've got three different boxes, and all tied into one antenna, a Yagi. That's like you said, on the chimney. You know, it's just on a 10-foot pole attached to the chimney with no rotator, facing west as best I could. Played around with it in the beginning. But I'd say in the last, 3 years or so, I don't know if the transmitting stations are doing better. For instance, I couldn't get two no matter what I did, no matter which way I turned that antenna. But I thought maybe, you know, I'll try it next week. No good. Could never get two. Got another box. Could not get two. And then all of a sudden, I'd say about a year or so ago, I was able to get two. And pretty solid. I lose it once in a while. I'm going to say 85% of the time. Let me drop it. Bad. I would say it's really good. I mean, cause from zero to it was like almost my worst one. Now I get all the other stations. You know, collectively, there's, you know, I know that, you know, for instance, there's Channel 11. Well, they have 11-1, 11-2, so it's like really one channel, but as far as I'm concerned, there's separate stations. You can watch different shows on each one. You have this TV, Channel 5 now came out with, I think they call it Me TV or something, that has movies on it, that's 5-2. They're adding them as they go, so I'm up to a total of, let's say, 39 possible stations. Maybe 10 of them are not working, or maybe 12 are not working at one time. a lot of them are Spanish stations. But for instance, the only strange thing that happens maybe with this problem of weather, when you have a lot of rain, I'll actually lose Channel 7. Channel 7 is my best station that comes in. But as that drops off, I pick up Channel 8, which is coming off the side of the beam, and which is really nothing but ABC anyway. So that's the report, Dick. I think that the transmitters are getting better, though. Well, a lot of my stations are coming in much better. Back to you, Dick.
Good answer for that.
Don, good news you've got there, Paul. Go ahead, Eric, and give us enough audio, Eric.
Little are people aware that there's been a lot of work done at Empire in terms of the antenna, the mast. Also, ABC, when he doesn't get it, is probably because they're transmitting from Four Times Square. There are backup transmitters at Four Times Square. That's just where some of the broadcasters decided they would put their backup. Actually, if you're watching WNYE, which is Channel 25, that is coming full-time from Four Times Square, so that'll give you a little idea of where things are. But one thing that has happened over the past couple of years, and not everybody has taken advantage of it, but the encoder technology, the Exciter technology, has improved tremendously, and the ability to produce the DTV signal, because we're talking about such fast rise times, they've actually improved the rise time, or the ability to change from a 1 to 0, whereas if you were to look at the slope of the rise time and the slope of the trailing time, they actually stand up a little straighter, so to speak, which helps the decoders a heck of a lot. P2I WK2, Jack.
We got 2-1, more comments.
Very fine, Paul. To get all of those rise times, what you're talking about, Paul, and make sure, Eric, and make sure it doesn't fall out of the bandwidth with those very sharp filters. That's a good trick. Go ahead, Paul. WS2N, K2LIW.
I don't want anybody to think they could go out by the antenna in the box and get all of this. Right from the beginning, I put a pre-amplifier in there. GE makes them. I bought one from Philips. They claim 18 dB. Well, whatever it is, you disconnect it and you lose like easily 50% of your shows, maybe more. So that is very important to have in line. It's plugged in all the time. You know, you plug into a 110 outlet to make that run, cable in, cable out. That's very important. Without that, you're dead in the water, Dick. And I thought maybe Channel 2 relocated their antennas or something. One day it just came to life. I couldn't believe it. The only thing I don't know what's happened with 4. Maybe Eric knows. 4 is like, I never get that 0 ever. Back to you.
Yeah, Eric, I have the impression from what you're telling me, Eric, that there is continuous, on a monthly basis, re-engineering taking place at the mast, at Empire State Building, and temporarily various stations use their broadcast backup transmitter at Four Times Square. And so continuous improvements, those so-called fill antennas that were out of phase on Channel 4, I'd like to believe that's all going to improve. So am I correct in assuming continuous improvement is taking place? And while we're at it, Eric, make us a guess as to when the new World Trade Center replacement, the Freedom Tower, will start doing some broadcasting. KE2EJ, K2LIW.
Well, that's an interesting question. There's technology improvements occur regularly on a daily basis. What's going on at Empire is pretty much done with. By the way, the backfill antenna is still out of phase with the main antenna. So there's a zone of, you don't get Channel 2 too well. But one of the things that's different now is that Channel 7 is on RF Channel 7, and Channel 11 is on RF Channel 11, and Channel 13 is on RF Channel 13, whereas 9 and 5 and 2, 4, are on two different sets of antennas. So the high Vs are all packed in one antenna to a set of combining. Fox has their own antenna on one side of the mast,
and the CBS has Zenith, and on the other side of the mast, a little bit lower, and the CBS antenna has channel 4, and it also has channel 9 on it, and the Fox antenna still is just Fox, if I'm correct.
Yeah, I believe so, but
the stuff around where the antennas were mounted that created the apertures for the antennas have been improved, the mounts have been improved, there's a lot of things that's gone on, so why is channel 4 is more of a problem? It is really, I think, no, where it is, it should be having the effects of the backfill antenna, so I don't know if I got a good answer to that. Now, let me let it drop.
WH-4-1-Y.
Stand by, Joe. Go ahead, Eric. We'll get to you, Joe.
Okay, what was the second part of your question, Dick?
Continuous upgrading on a monthly basis taking place on the hottest piece of radio real estate on planet Earth. There's got to be more transmitters, high power, in a short space on that mast and empire. I don't think anything else in the United States can, or maybe the world, can challenge that. In fact, when they turn off the transmitters at 3 o'clock in the morning because you're going to go up there and change the light bulb, I bet you the steel in that mast is hot because of all the outer that's hitting it. You're telling us about that, and you're starting to say, boy, it's a real good story as to what's going to happen when we start broadcasting at the New Freedom Tower. KE2EJ, K2LAW.
Yeah, that was it. It put my mind
on. Okay.
The Freedom Tower. Everybody paid their $3 million to reserve this space, but I'm willing to bet you, and I'm really willing to bet you, that none of the broadcasters are going to go there. With all the money and the effort that they put into Empire and 4 Times Square and the shrinking size of their audience, there's no reason for them to go there. So that's my take on it. And as of this date, as far as I'm aware, none of the New York Broadcast Council has actually made a single move to become part of that facility.
Wow. In theory, the most beautiful, tall building in the world with this beautiful mast, and you're telling me that there is evidence to say that for some period of time it's going to be radio-wise unoccupied with broadcast transmitters? I'd like to believe that that's temporary, that maybe because of financial problems the move over there is going to be a little bit slow. But with that extra altitude, isn't that going to give somebody an advantage if they're willing to pay the tariff? KE2EJ, K2LAW.
Well, at this point, there's really no point because of the cable systems that don't get a fiber feed, there still are a bunch of cable systems and satellite systems that take the various stations off the air from receiving locations in and around the metropolitan area. The FM could go possibly to World Trade, to the Freedom Tower, but that in itself creates its own problems in terms of reception in Manhattan. So they're more likely, but possibly less likely to go there because of local coverage, where the major audience is in centered around the city as opposed to being far away. And besides, there's not a lot of FM broadcasters at Empire anymore. They're spread all over the place. And there's a whole lot of them at 4 Times Square. The rent's also cheaper. There's a lot of little things going on there. But I seriously doubt, with the shrinking audience that they have, that since they are getting the coverage that they need into the important distribution places, so it doesn't make sense to go spend another $10, $12 million there, go move into that building. And I think that's probably going to stay right there.
What is the altitude of the antenna at 4 Times Square? And how does it have such good coverage by comparison to Empire? Almost as good as Empire? Over to you, Eric.
I don't have the specifics. It's a bit lower. Eastern Empire, not by a lot. It's an interesting map that they created. And going east and west and north and south, when you look at it, there's nothing blocking its view. You can see that building from here. So, you know, line of sight.
Good information. See, I know we've stuck on this subject for quite a while. We drifted very far to the left of what Joe originally asked. Part of what's going on here is that I believe inside of each Sirius ham radio operator is a little guy that would love to be working in the broadcast industry. I mean, that's where real high-power RF is taking place, and fame and fortune and so on. So, Joe, I know we went pretty far left of center of your original question. W-A-2-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W in the tech man.
Just to respond to what you said, RF broadcast engineers are a dying breed. There are very few of them, and manufacturers are usually doing the same thing these days.
So is this another one of these situations where if you want to get a guy smart in that area, you have to hire a ham, Eric, go ahead.
Most of them are too old and they're dying. A lot of the hams of today are appliance operators.
Not the ones that signed into the TechNet. The ones that signed into the TechNet are people who really care about where those electrons go and how they create radiation, how that antenna works, how the transmitter works, how that feed line works. There's a small, hardcore group of guys. The TechNet would not have lasted for 31 years if there wasn't this hardcore group, just like Tom Williams, WA1MBA, with his microwave reflector, WA1MBA.org. Is it org? Yeah, it is .org. There's a hardcore group of guys that just love microwaves. They can't get on a high enough frequency. Yes, there's a minority, but they're always going to be there, Eric, and as I see it, you want a guy who understands RF, you got to hire a ham. 50% of the time, I think that is the answer. You can challenge that if you like. K2EJ, K2RAW.
No, I have no reason to challenge it. And yes, there are a small, hardcore group of people in here and in Los Angeles and in Washington and a few other places. You even think about this in broadcasting. Now, I'm talking specifically about television, not radio. You must know a lot of camera operators, videotape guys, production people that no longer have a job. News no longer has camera people. The director not only switches the program these days, took the place of the technical director, but he also controls where the cameras are. They're all about it. You will have an audio guy. That guy can't really be eliminated. But the audio guy might not only be doing audio, he might be doing graphics at the same time. The actual production side of broadcasting has been reduced so much. There's so many guys that have been in this business for so long that are just simply out of work because there's no work for them. So that also applies to the technical operations where more and more they rely on the manufacturer, and of course the equipment is reliable to the extent that you don't need a full-time person in the broadcast transmitter anymore. Most transmitters these days are unmanned. K2RW, K2J.
But when it comes to understanding the way the transmitter works, the way the exciter works, the way the modulation works, the way the antenna works, the way the broadcast the way the transmission line works, the way the safety equipment works, for Channel 21 and Channel 13, there's a guy named Eric, KE2EJ, that's heavily involved in that. If for some reason he went somewhere else, Channel 21 and Channel 13, what would they use as a backup for that particular position, Eric, KE2EJ, K2RAW?
Okay. We might have some guy that we're paying a very low salary to, and when something goes wrong, you'll call up the transmitter manufacturer, and we'll describe the problem to him. And the transmitter manufacturer will say, oh, well, it's this board, pull that out, we'll ship you a new one. And in terms of, like, if you have a feed line or an antenna problem, well, we'll call a guy who has a company called Radnet that actually does all the installation of the broadcast antennas and the pipes and all the auxiliary stuff that makes it go. So we don't necessarily have to replace the really intelligent people that used to keep this stuff on
transmitters, and to the extent that you need to adjust them every day and make sure that they're right. I mean, the IoTs that we have, like an MSDC, basically, once you set it up and turn it on, because when you bring it, when you first install it, it has to be installed by the manufacturer and has to have its proof of performance done. Once that's done, that's it. No tuning, no fuss, no bother until something blows up.
Okay, what I'm hearing, Eric, is that if you weren't there, there are methods by which they could limp along at a disadvantage. And now they'd be at the mercy of those vendors of that hardware. And there are times when they're going to be fibbed to and pay a lot of money and waste a lot of time. That's my belief. You got to stay healthy, Eric. Have you considered making a instructional video that explains what you do and how you do it? I'm having some fun with you. I'm back here for a quick one on that, Eric. K2EJ, K2LIW.
No, every big transmitter manufacturing company like Larkin or Harris or Comark, they run instructional classes, so there actually are videos and stuff like that. But you can go for training on a manufacturer's individual piece of equipment. They basically give you an overview enough to be able to figure out, you know, when something's wrong, how to recognize it, and how to deal with it. Not necessarily how to open up the board and fix it. And there's also guys like me who have lost their job that have become consultants and that travel around from station to station doing upkeep on transmitters, and, you know, within 24 hours being available to do a repair. And most metropolitan area stations or big stations that have large audiences don't have one transmitter, they have two. So when one fails, they turn the other one on. And by the way, my transmitter in Plainview for Channel 21, the main transmitter died. I'm waiting for a power supply to come, but I'm not fixing it. It uses 443 phase, and I really don't have the facilities. And it's a switching supply. And I ain't sticking my hands in that thing. I'd rather stick my hands in a 28,000 volt 3-amp supply that's pretty plain rather than have to deal with a switching supply that's running at those kinds of current and that kind of power, because, you know, I just don't have the... I can't even plug it in, so to speak, let alone deal with it. I mean, I could if I had to, but the facility's not set up for that, and I ain't taking a chance on that. That stuff is nasty. So, you know, what can I tell you?
K2RWK2J.
KC2AZ.
AZ done. AZ recognized it. I worked with a guy who had a screwdriver fall across a 440 volt three-phase line, and the smoke and flames that created singed his eyebrows and whatever. In the order in which people want to make a comment, let's close this one out, Joe. I know you want to make a final. W2RYY, the guy who asked the original question, K2RIW, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm going to lose my train of thought here. You know, a 10-second comment goes into 10 minutes, you know? This is in reference to what Paul said. I still see several channels off the air that have what you call a scallop pattern, like RF28, RF33, and RF38, which is the channels he mentioned that he gets. And compared to the other channels which have a nice clean pattern, there's a definite difference in how you receive these depending on the average signal strength. They don't come in as well as others. I get them all the time, but if you have something that's marginal, these channels are going to be the first ones to go out. Back to you.
And as you look across that large head display, across that 6 megs of bandwidth, and you see that scallop pattern, you then have to ask yourself, is the scallop pattern coming from the peaks and valleys of your particular antenna and amplifier and transmission line? Is it the multipath in front of your antenna? It is my belief, and I'm going to check with Eric on this one, that the broadcast transmitter itself would not have a scallop pattern of a couple of dB of peak to valley across that barge head if that transmitter is working correctly. That if it did have that, I think you'd be violating some FCC rules for broadcast quality. That's a guess. KE2EJ, K2LIW.
K2IW, K2J. Let's put it this way. I think the rule
say that it needs to be flat within 0.2 of a dB.
I can look that up.
But let's put it this way. Nobody broadcasts this scallop pattern where the pilot is way, you know, 3 or 4 dB higher than the, say, the center of the image or across the 6 megahertz, so you see like a sine wave or a concave shape to the pattern. I can probably guess that which ones he's talking about, which would be the stations that are connected to the CBS antenna, which has the backfill antenna on it. And if you ever had the chance to look at it when the backfill antenna is turned off, you would see them being as perfectly flat. So, that's my answer to it.
Okay, let me reword what I just heard. The basic transmitter is flat within 2/10 of a dB. But once that signal gets into the multiple antennas with the interferometry and backfill, what really gets broadcast at his particular elevation and azimuth angle out to Great River could result in scalloping that he's seeing. And for that scalloping to have high enough Q to give him those peaks and valleys across 6 megs with his antenna and his preamplifier, it's rather unlikely it's occurring because of his hardware. It's because of the pattern transmitted in space of interferometry of a backfill antenna at the broadcast center. Is that a possibility, Eric? KE2EJ, KQLIW?
Absolutely, Dave. Although I will not say that I actually feel that a lot of preamps that the whole antenna is not really good for digital television because a lot of them make too much noise. But as far as the scalloping goes, that could be a result of multipath or what you would like to call an intersymbol distortion, where you're getting various differing amounts on a linear basis of addition and subtraction of the symbol from one symbol being ejected out in time with the simultaneous symbol being ejected out at a later or an earlier time from an opposing antenna as being in an area where the two signals mix.
What I'm looking at though right now, Eric, interferometry wise, in order to make, let me pick a number, 6 scallops across 6 megacycles. Maybe he's only got 3, but if he's got 6 scallops across 6 megacycles, each scallop represents 360 degrees of phase shift. We're talking about 360 degrees per 1 megahertz of frequency deviation, frequency variation. That's a microsecond, that takes a microsecond of delay. A microsecond of delay in free space propagation, that's a lot. That's a 1,000 nanoseconds. One path is 1,000 feet longer than another path. For that to take place at fill antennas at 2 different altitudes at Empire, easy to do. But for Joe's local environment to do that, for his antenna to have enough Q to do that, for his preamplifier to do that, I mean, if his preamplifier has 3 dB of slant across the band, top to bottom, I'd accept that. But to make a scallop every megacycle, that's not easy. You see where I'm going on this one, Eric? KE2EJ, KQLAW.
Before you go crazy on this, we already entertained this subject months ago, okay? And the differences I got was about 2 to 2.5 megahertz between these patterns, not 1 meg.
That's only the minor details. You're talking about 500 nanoseconds versus 1,000 nanoseconds. That's 500 feet or 1,000 feet of difference in path length to do it. I'm having trouble believing that your local environment can do that, but the antennas at broadcast center, the fill antennas, with a number of feet of difference in altitude, I think they can do it. See what Eric's got to say on this one. KE2EJ, KQLIW.
Guys, if you want to figure out the propagation delay between leaving the transmitter and hitting one antenna, going through, what is it, I think it's about 125 feet or 130 feet of coax versus the backfill antenna, which has over 400 feet of coax. Okay, you can figure out the time delay there. And I'm not saying that the preamps will cause scalloping. The problem is the preamps create impulse noise, you know. They don't use really low noise transistors in those things, although they're getting smarter these days. But you could have, say, water tower, say, 15 miles away, causing a signal that you would consider to be multipath, at difference of 30 miles between the reflected signal and the direct received signal will also create a scalloping. But the kind of scalloping that I think you see is pretty much a concave sort of look that might run across 2 or 3 megahertz. That's the backfill antenna doing it.
The water tower 15 miles away is very unlikely, Eric. You're now talking about what's called bistatic radar cross-section. When the distance between you and the reflecting object is X number of miles, and its signal is falling off 12 dB per octave of distance, for that to be a big enough reflector, if it was a great big billboard, like an outdoor movie screen, yes, maybe. And if it's just a specular reflection and everything's aimed just right, an ordinary round water tower that far away, giving a strong enough signal to make that amount of scallop, it's difficult. So as I see it, Joe, we have a little bit of a mystery here as to where the scalloping in your case is coming from. We're going to have to move on. what I'm proposing to do, with John's permission, is that we've got Steve and Ed. Ed and Steve in that order.
Ed, Dick.
I can let you know when the backfill antenna goes off and you can look at it.
Roger, Dodger. We got Ed and Steve who signed in that we should really try to get to, because I know that the question you're about to ask, John, is going to take a while. It's a question that quite a few people are interested in, and we're going to get fairly deep into resonance, impedance matching, and what it all means. I'd like to put that after we go to Ed and Steve, so that we at least handle the people who signed in, and then we can take our time with that one. Yeah, we're going to be a little bit delayed when it comes to the mailbag, but still by way of the recording amateurradio.tv, people will have delay time and still be able to get that information. You see where I'm going here on this one, John, with your permission. KC2WGB, K2LIW in the TechNav.
Oh, absolutely, Dick. Go for it. Yeah, I can wait. No problem at all.
And I had a comment.
Okay. If your comment is on one of the subjects that we just discussed, go right ahead. terrible. Wes, you got it, Wes.
With everything that you said about the over-the-air broadcasting, there is something that I would like to bring to your attention, if we have a time for it, which is similar in nature, and it goes with the same pattern. That would be who controls whom and who pays whom. And that might put a little bit more light with what's going on with the broadcast TV and all of the broadcasting services that are delivered to the household. But if you see no time frame for it, we can do it later.
Of the information you sent me this week, I was looking at one of those particular videos, and I came to an interesting conclusion that I want to go to a little bit later. We're going to be discussing that during the deeper portion of the TechNet later on.
No. It wasn't about that. We're talking about a subject of whether we're going to have a broadcasting of TV in the future or near future, or we're going to have it killed. We're talking about who controls whom and who pays whom. And I sent you another email that was about a bubble, which appears to be a privately held a non-profit organization. And that gives a lot of light of what that quite very much unknown to many small company does with national science, with federal science, and with national institutions like universities whatsoever. And that was actually what I was trying to corroborate or brought into your attention in reference to broadcasting, so you might know that who, you know, what's going on.
Dick, he's talking about a management group that the government hires to manage certain science projects. That's basically what he's speaking about.
Yes, but this is only about the science, but you may also extrapolate that to the broadcasting and the way that the government could see it by the private business that is in big money may see it as well. The father has a office in Saudi Arabia, in India, in Japan, certain joint ventures. Bubbles is being seen also as a privately owned company of international nature. But at the same time, Bubbles control Brookhaven, Brook University, Idaho National Laboratory, Electric Power Research Institute, the Oak Ridge National Laboratory, the new renewable energy. Department of, on behalf of Department of Homeland Security, National Biodefense Analysis and Countermeasure Center, and in United Kingdom, Department of Energy and Climate Change, and UK National Nuclear Laboratory. Now, Bubbles is located in Ohio. If I remember properly, it's Cleveland, Ohio. And it is focusing on the contract research and development work in the areas of metals and metal science. At the same time, if you look who is financing them, you know, on who they finance, when they asking you also on the website for your voluntary contribution, if you want to, you see 54% of Republicans over there. And when you look at the names of the contributors, or eventually you look at the names that this company is supporting in political arena, then you might find the big names: Dave Hobson, Barack Obama, Patrick Murray, Doug Hastings, Maria Conwell, and whatsoever. And to see it.
Yeah, some of the confusion is that you're pronouncing it as a battle. It's Battelle. The Battelle Memorial Institute in Columbus, Ohio. A very potent organization that, for instance, did a hell of a lot of the research of the hardware that apparently fell in Roswell, New Mexico. And if you read that book that I've been talking about, you'll hear an awful lot, about the Battelle Institute and what reverse engineering they've done. And yes, they're not a well advertised to the public, to the general public, what Battelle does. Battelle Memorial Institute. You Google those words and start reading what that organization in Columbus, Ohio has done, can do, what power they've got, what major research organizations they have a lot to do with. That's an interesting subject. And we can't go there right now, but you've hit on something very interesting, Wes. I'm trying to get to the two guys who signed in, Ed and Steve, before we put them to sleep. KC2QYT. Ed, I hope you're still with us. K2LIW in the TechNet.
KC2PYT, that's Papa Yankee Tango. This is Ed. I have a question that might be, I don't know if it's a little too abstract, but it has to do with nanometer scale antennas. I saw an article talking about graphene antennas, and something in the article caught my eye, and it talked about how because of some peculiar propagation phenomenon in the graphene antenna, it was able to resonate at frequencies substantially lower than you would be able to obtain with a similarly sized metal antenna. And I was just curious if you had any insight, or if anyone had any insight as to the physical phenomenon taking place that allows that to happen.
Yeah, funny you should ask. The latest issue of the monthly publication of the Antennas and Propagation Society, IEEE Antennas and Propagation, of which I'm a life member. They've got some articles on what I'm going to call metamaterials. There are various ways that you can synthesize materials that you use for an antenna that has some very wild antenna characteristics with reference to bandwidth, impedance matching, size, and whatever. And the equivalent inductance per inch or capacitance per inch, when you start getting down to graphene, in other words, carbon-reinforced light materials, you take carbon molecules that, if you're smart enough, you can put them together in very unusual arrangements where you can synthesize what under a high-power microscope, if you go down that far, would look like a whole bunch of very fine hairs. This allows you to synthesize materials that have got some very unusual properties. Let me drop. And the latest few issues of Antennas and Propagation, also Antennas and Propagation Society magazine, also the Terahertz magazine that I get, you're on to something here, as I see it, Ed. We, the general public, don't have a great deal of understanding yet, but as you start using nano-sized materials of these exotic ways of synthesizing them, you can develop all kinds of properties you've never seen before. A metamaterial used in an antenna can synthesize dielectrics, where ordinarily a dielectric, a piece of plastic, would have a dielectric constant of 3. In other words, you put this piece of plastic between two plates of an air capacitor, and the capacitance of, in picofarads of the capacitor, goes up by 3 to 1. That's what dielectric constant of 3 means. So an ordinary piece of plexiglass can do that. You put some of these metamaterials in there, you can synthesize dielectric constant. That doesn't have to be a positive number. It can be a negative number. And the number it has can change as a function of frequency in exotic ways. We're starting to discuss, as I said, the whole field of metamaterials. It's a bunch of recent research going on there. You haven't heard nothing yet. But I've often said there are 5,000 kinds of antennas in existence right now. You open up any one of the 4 editions of the Antenna Engineering Handbook, and if you count all the antennas there, there's probably 5,000 kinds. You start adding metamaterials, there's a whole lot of brand new antennas going to be created you ain't never seen before. Let me drop. Now, these exotic materials, Ed, you and I are not going to use it on our 80-meter dipole. Could we use it on our 900-megacycle compact antenna? Absolutely. When you can synthesize very high dielectric constant materials, materials that change dielectric constant as a function of frequency in exotic ways, all kinds of brand new antennas in small sizes become possible. So you're onto something. I don't know a great deal about it yet, but I'm seeing hints about it in these journals that I'm reading. You Google those words, you're going to find more, and it's a brand new science from my point of view, Ed. I know I haven't answered your question, but I told you what little I know. KC2PYT, K2LAW in the TechNet.
Yeah, it all seems super interesting. Like, they're talking about stuff, on the nanometer scale. So you conceivably could have nanomachines that are able to now to communicate with one another wirelessly. And the little reading that I've been doing to try and piece together what's happening here, it seems like in the case of the graphene antenna, at least, you have some kind of surface wave that propagates along the graphene sheet, where graphene is, a single atom-thick sheet of interlinked carbon atoms. It seems like there's something about this surface wave as it propagates along the sheet that allows it to couple allows it to couple to photons. Sorry about that. Allows it to couple to photons that have a frequency other than what you would expect. And I'm just trying to figure out what the mechanism is there. But I'll keep reading. And I guess if anybody else has some insights, I'd love to hear them.
very interesting.
These graphene materials are capable of having electrical conductivity and thermal conductivity that's way beyond anything we've seen before. When it comes to high frequency, very high conductivity, electrical properties, all kinds of great things are possible. What magazine or journal or article were you reading when you read this so far? And by the way, that surface wave you're talking about, sometimes it's called a slow wave structure. And so if at the microscopic or the atomic level you can generate a slow wave structure at your particular operating frequency, you're capable of making much more compact antennas. I didn't say high gain, but small size of high efficiency antennas. So where were you getting that information from, Ed, and where should we go to read what you've read so far? KC2PYC, K2RAW.
This is coming off of the IEEE Spectrum blog, which apparently deals with nanotechnology. It's on spectrum.ieee.org/nanoclast, N-A-N-O-C-L-A-S-T. And I was also able to find a Wikipedia article dealing with a phenomenon called surface plasmon polariton waves, which is, you know, kind of high-level stuff that I've been piecing together while I've been waiting for my turn to come around. This is super interesting stuff, and if you've got a physics background at all, maybe you can weigh in as well.
Surface plasmon polariton what?
Surface plasmon, P-L-A-S-M-O-N, polariton, P-O-L-A-R-I-T-O-N. It sounds like it comes out of science fiction.
I'd like to hear you say that five times in a row real fast. And by the way, you're saying that's in Spectrum. I get the monthly journal from the IEEE called Spectrum. I'm a little bit behind in reading my last couple of issues. And I think I vaguely remember seeing articles on this subject. Looks like good stuff. And I see it's a material that's going to have a lot of future. And when it comes to graphene having extremely high strength for the number of atoms that are there, when it comes to a real high strength requirement, the so-called space elevator, which we're dreaming about. In theory, if you can build a space elevator, sort of a skyhook, literally, if you can get materials that are strong enough per strength to weight ratio, then getting materials into low orbit or high orbit by much less expensive techniques than using a 5,000 pound thrust rockets, 5 million pound thrust rockets, would be one hell of an improvement. There's a lot of steps required between here and there, but some of these exotic materials are possibly capable of doing that. Keep up the good work, Ed, and report back to us periodically as to what you find. KC2 PYT for a final, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Coming.
Okay, will do, Dick. I'll let you know if I find out, if I have managed to figure out exactly what's going on in here.
Okay, give us a brief comment, Wesley.
I found a very short explanation for the phenomena, which is the conventional photonic band gap, which is being called PBG structures, composed of the region with the periodic modulation of the refractive index that does not allow the propagation of electromagnetic waves in certain interval of wavelengths. So there will be, for example, exhibit of PBG effect. Very much straightforward explanation and very interesting. Thank you very much for that information.
Yeah, as I see it, more to follow. You ain't seen nothing yet. And when you can generate materials that have negative refractive index and negative magnetic mu characteristics, and you start combining them, the way a signal goes in there and the way it gets bent and the way it gets focused is very different. Mother Nature does not naturally produce these materials that are now being artificially produced. You ain't seen nothing yet on that one. Steve. I hope we haven't put you to sleep. We've kept you waiting an awful long time. KC2 MDP, still with us, Steve. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Oh, yeah, Dick, no problem. I'm always here for the long haul. I'd like to say good evening to you and good evening to everyone on the net. And you can give me the super quick brief answer because I know we got to get things moving along here. Okay, here's my problem. I have a ICOM 7000 in sideband mode, which is 100 watts, with car running. The display actually flicker. Now, what I think is happening is either the battery's getting old or the alternator's getting old, and it's not producing enough voltage to, you know, satisfy this radio. This radio seems to be extremely voltage sensitive. And my idea, rather than change the battery and change the alternator, which as far as the car goes, I mean, it starts fine, it runs fine, you know, the only problem is this radio. Is it possible, I have a couple of these power supply capacitors, you know, the beer can looking ones, computer grade power supply capacitors. Is it possible that I stick a couple of those in, you know, at the actual, you know, power termination of the radio? Do you think that would help? Back to you, Dick.
Question on that, Dick.
Yeah, I've got a couple of questions, too. If I understand correctly from what you're saying, Steve, your display on your IC7000, which I think you're using in a mobile environment, you kept saying a 12 volts inverter and whatever, it sounds like it's in your car, and I think you're saying the display is flickering. And have you had the chance to measure the voltage you're delivering to the radio? Is the radio, when the car is running and the alternator is running, is the radio getting 13.8 volts even when you're transmitting? That's question number one that I'm going to ask, but John's got another question first. KC2WGB, K2RIW, go ahead, John.
KC2WGB. Yeah, Dick, similar to yours, I want to know if without, before he does anything, when he keys up, does it flicker more?
So, what's your best guess, Joe, here we go, Steve, that you're, what's the voltage that you're delivering to the radio when the car is running more than idle speed, so you know you're giving it enough voltage, or at least can you confirm the voltage you're delivering? How long have you had this flicker? Is it temperature sensitive? Some of my electronics in my automobile, when I first turn on the car on a cold day, it doesn't behave anywhere near as well as when things warm up later on. So is there temperature? Is there voltage? Transmit versus receive? Give us a few more of the clues of the malady, Steve. KC2 MDP, KQLAW in the TechNet.
Okay, yes, Dick, very good. Yes, you surmised, yes, it's in the mobile. You figured I would have done that. You know, I was just playing with it tonight, and it's been an ongoing problem for a couple of months. And just happens tonight, I was waiting for some food to be made, so I was sitting out in the car playing with the mobile, and it brought this up. I did not check voltage yet, that I will do, but it just seemed, you know, past couple of months, I would say, that this has been a problem. It used to be when the car was off, it would flicker. Now, when you start the car, it'll actually flicker. You know, if you give a good whistle into the microphone, you know, as it's trying to produce that 100 watts, you can actually see that screen waver a little bit. It doesn't do it when you first key up. There's no problem with receive. You go into the FM mode, let's say on 2 meters, which is only producing 50 watts, you really don't see the flicker. 440, which I think the radio is rated at 30 watts, you don't see it at all. It's only basically like 6, 10, and it's sideband high power. Back to you.
KC2QIQ, the comment? Yeah, my first question is going to be, is it only doing it in the sideband mode? Is that what I heard? Glenn, I wonder if you own that exact radio, and maybe you've seen something similar. KC2QIQ, K2LIW. Go ahead, Glenn.
Sure do, Dick, and I sure have seen that problem before. What it is, it's actually a pretty simple fix. I'm pretty sure what happened is your fuses. For some reason, the inline fuses that ICOM sent with them, I don't know if they're underrated or just whatever the issue is, but after a period of time, the fuse, even though you measure them with an ohmmeter, they measure okay. You start transmitting, and then they start breaking down to some point where actually you key up the radio and you'll get no output anymore. My first suggestion is change the fuses. But my think the long-term solution is, if you can, cut the fuse and the fuse.